Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Megan Clardy, here today with fellow producer Michael O'Connell.
Hello.
And we're joined in the studio today by Glenn Weldon. You may know Glenn as a panelist on NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour podcast. He's also a contributor to NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See. Over his career, Glenn has worn many hats. He's been a theater critic, a science writer, and a bookstore clerk, of all things. His fiction and criticism has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, and many other publications. Glenn is also the author of Superman, the Unauthorized Biography, which is a cultural history of the comic book hero. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Yes.
So how did you become a writer? I mean, you obviously have had all these hats, but starting at the beginning, what made you want to write?
Well, I mean, I knew that I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't follow that for a long time because for the longest time, I thought I wanted to be a marine biologist. At age four, I knew I wanted to be a marine biologist.
I, too, wanted to be a marine biologist.
Oh, I have some stories to tell you.
I have stories right back at you.
Okay,
and I was afraid we were going to be talking about comic books, but now we're going to be talking about
whales.
Sea animals.
Let me quick
dolphins.
Like a bunny. I memorized the Latin names of every whale and dolphin. I watched Day of the Dolphin. I was a competitive swimmer.
competitive swimmer, because it might help you.
I thought so. I became a scuba certified at age 14, the youngest you can do it. And
wow.
I watched every Jacques Cousteau special, and I knew I wanted to be a marine biologist. Meantime, all these teachers are saying, hey, you know, you don't suck at writing. And I was like, thank you for your input, but I know what I want to do. And I went straight to marine biology school, where the first day they sit down all of you fresh-faced young kids together, and they say, now, how many of you are here? Because you saw a lot of Jacques Cousteau specials, and you want to talk to dolphins.
You're like,
and we all just go, yep. and the guy goes, Jacques Cousteau was a filmmaker, not a scientist. And the entire room, but I thought, this is hazing, right? They just are trying to weed us out. So I was like, I'm sticking with it. And any class that involved any kind of math, which was all of them.
Right.
Because you had your chemical oceanography, your physical oceanography, your physics 1-2, you had your calculus 1-2, you had quantitative analysis, you had your organic chemistry 1-2. Anything that involved math, C, D. Anything that involved memorizing words like biology and evolution and all that stuff, A. And in the meantime, because it was miserable, right? So the marine biology station at the school was just these aquariums and tubes and plastic buckets, and it smelled like rotting fish on a dock. And every time I would take an elective course in the fine arts building, it was like I would walk in and the smell of chalk and books and leather, and it'd be like peacocks walking down the hallway,
right,
and people playing harps, and it just felt like this is where I belong. But because the school was at the eastern tip of Long Island, in Southampton, actually, it was where a lot of writers would come during the summer,
mm-hmm.
and drink and exploit young college kids.
Mm-hmm.
And if you stayed out there and were prepared to be abused, you could make a lot of money. So I would stay out there, and I would take all these courses at the college, creative writers. So like people like Vonnegut would come out there, Ethan Koenig would come out there. Alice Munro came out there once and just lectured, not gave classes or anything. And I thought to myself, this is what I need to do. So I started after that, after graduating from college and knowing that all my friends went off to count fish in Idaho and knowing it's not for me.
There are three fish.
I'm not good in flannel, so I can't. It wouldn't work for me. I said I just wanted to start writing short stories. So I did. I was living at home, and using my dad's postage meter, I was just sending out all kinds of short stories. And back in the 90s, I'll tell you, it was a numbers game. If you sent out enough to literary magazines, you know, because every college has a literary magazine, you just send out enough, you're going to get published. And so numbers game, like 1 out of 13, 1 out of 9, 1 out of 5, whatever,
okay,
would eventually get published. Nothing huge, but like just enough to kind of build up a base, I guess.
Right, a resume.
A resume, right, and which would then sway potential editors of literary magazines because they've seen you've been published so many times. It's all a scam.
It wasn't that you were actually talented. It was just a numbers game.
Oh, God, no.
I don't really believe you.
If you read some of that early stuff, no. It was all stuff, you know, where the mailbox eats people. It was like there was anything could happen because it was fun. Because look at me. I can do make-em-ups. It was awful.
It's all about perpetuating the workshops.
Exactly. Well, see, this is it. And that sent me right to Iowa. I went to the writer's workshop for 2 years, which is where you go to live, eat, and drink, and sleep fiction. Which I did. It was a really great program. but there's nothing else to do there. It's Iowa City. and after 2 years, I was like, I know what this is. I know what this is about. And I don't want to live this particular life anymore, because all my friends were then preparing themselves to go and just move from like fellowship to fellowship for the rest of their lives, just kind of going from you know, from workshop to workshop, fellowship to fellowship.
Right.
And it just felt like I needed to get away. So I got a job here in D.C., writer in residence at St. Albans School, which is a 1-year gig. And you were it's a really smart thing that they do, because St. Albans is this very buttoned down, conservative, private boys school, where they want to give these kids something besides. They're training these kids, the future leaders of America, to read teachers. They're training them so that we are going to give you, the kids learn, we're going to give you exactly what we think you want, right? So it's about training kids to become really charismatic and political in a way.
Huh.
And so they know this about themselves. So they say, let's do a creative writing course for seniors that's just not that. Because you can't, they can't, the skills they have learned to read a teacher and know exactly what they want won't work in creative writing, because the creative writing is not about that. Creative writing is not about having criteria. Well, this is good, this is bad. It's about just write. And so the woman who had the job before me was one of these, wearable art, giant rings, kind of smoked cigars, and was a bohemian. Mm-hmm. And that's what they wanted. I could tell that's what they wanted from this position, because I got in there and I was like, so we're going to read some Poe, and the entire thing just because I wasn't nearly crazy enough for them. I wasn't entertaining. I wasn't wild enough.
Arty enough.
Wasn't nearly arty enough, but it was a good gig. But then after that, I just started working in bookstores. I've worked in bookstores all my life.
But you stayed here.
Stayed here. I liked it here. And I worked at Lambda Rising, the old gay bookstore down on Connecticut Avenue. It was a good store. I thought it would be like working in any other bookstore, where I would maybe start a book club like I did in other bookstores, and people would come to me and talk about what contemporary fiction do you want, and it was lube and porn. That's what it was. It was basically I should have known
that. You're like, maybe I should politics and prose this,
exactly.
Or that's Kramer books.
Would you like to discuss Edmund White? No, the porn is back there.
That's a retailer that knows its audience.
Exactly. Oh, and rainbow bumper stickers and all that kind of stuff. So it was a little dispiriting. Yeah. So in the meantime, I was temping all over the I temped in every nonprofit in D.C., which is saying something.
That's a lot.
It is saying.
Yeah. And eventually I found this place that I work at now, which is a humble little nonprofit cancer research charity that needed at that time somebody to write about science, needed to do press releases and stuff. So that's my day job. That's what I do 9 to 5. I was a temp there. I'm now director of education and communications. But in the meantime, while all this is happening, I am making jokes on the internet, and I'm sending out jokes about various television shows to my friends, one of whom was Trey Graham, who was a theater critic for the City Paper. He worked at USA Today, but this was before he came to NPR. And I was making fun of these shows called Boy Meets Boy, and
this show isn't at all like that.
Exactly.
Defies its expectations.
Playing it straight, where gay guys pretended to be straight guys pretended to be gay. Uh-huh. Reality competition, terrible, but exultantly terrible, gleefully terrible. And he said, "Well, this is good. Do you want to review theater?" And I was like, "Well, that doesn't connect. I have no training in that. That's not a thing I can do."
Sure, let's do it.
but he suggested. He kept after me for a while, and eventually I gave it a shot. Because one of the things about my writing style is that it's very discursive, and it goes on. And I thought, what I need training in is journalism, essentially, is writing quick and short and turning it around. Because the way the City Paper works at the Times, I think it still does, is you see the thing on Sunday or Saturday in a preview, and the deadline is Monday morning first thing. So, like, if I saw something on a Sunday night, I'd stay up all night writing that thing and turn it in. And that was incredibly good training. I learned a lot. It wasn't my passion, but it was a good gig. And then eventually, Trey went to NPR, And he worked with Linda Holmes, who was starting up the pop culture blog, Monkey See. She's a brilliant and very funny writer. And I think he showed some of my stuff to her. We kind of talked a little bit about what we could do. And for a while there, I was turning in one piece a week, one blog post a week about something that's happening in the comic scene. Mm-hmm. And that's how Pop Culture Happy Hour happened.
So had you been interested in comics before this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, growing up, yes. Yes, it was a big thing. I mean, it's what occupies your entire life when you're a kid. Then you go away, and during the whole sort of literary fiction era, I disdained them. But it was also the 90s when comics started to suck. You'll remember, Michael, how many comics started to suck during the 90s and became sort of extreme and ultra-violent and
Image.
Terrible. And Image. So it was a good time to get out of comics. And then I started to get back into them. And, you know, not just superhero comics, but all kinds of stuff. And it's a huge and growing and really vibrant and fascinating scene now.
Yes, yes. And it's actually a good source for entertainment writing and pop culture. I mean, it's in our pop culture now.
Yeah,
it is. Thanks to the movies, thanks to the TV shows, mm-hmm. Thanks to Comic-Con. We were talking before we started that you were at Comic-Con with your podcast mates.
Yeah.
And, what was that experience as far as – well, let's talk about that. What was your experience this year there?
Oh, it was great. I mean, last year I was my first time, and I was guided by my colleague's mother, Stephen Thompson's mother, Maggie Thompson. We were talking about her as well.
She's a big deal in the Cracker Factory.
She's
in the
huge deal in the comic scene. She
really?
And her husband started up a series of fanzines, which essentially, not to put too fine a point on, created comic book fandom. So all of this is pretty much her fault.
Legitimized
it. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
They ran a newspaper in the 1980s, the Comic Buyer's Guide, which they did news stories about comics, which really nobody else was doing.
Comics journalism, yeah.
Comics journalism. It was before... before the internet took off and people were blogging about comics and stuff,
right.
they were interviewing creators, they were doing histories, they were, yeah. you know, doing a lot of the grunt work in journalism.
Exactly. And, you know, her husband, Don, was writing these books that were comics histories, the first comics histories of the yeah. medium, the field, the personalities.
We had Stephen Thompson in here on the podcast, and mm-hmm. I didn't realize that his mom was Maggie Thompson. His father was Don Thompson.
He's I'd rather have your mom in
the doc. No. Well, this is about media. We could have talked about the Comic Buyer's Guide.
And he was great, by the way.
He
was really great.
So you're there with basically Mr. and Mrs. Comics.
Yep. Yeah. And, Don passed away, but Maggie is still just huge, and she is doing panels, and she is fantastic, and she's got so much energy, and she has this enthusiasm, just this enthusiasm for every aspect of it, and she wants to meet everybody. She doesn't need to meet everybody. She already knows everybody. I'm a little bit more reticent. I'm a little bit more suspicious. I'm a little bit more jaded and cynical, and this experience is overwhelming in the way you expect it to be overwhelming. It's unbridled enthusiasm, as I said on the podcast, and it can be a little creepy, frankly, when there's just all of this positive energy all around you, and you're just like this little island of
the last time I went to Comic-Con, I spent like maybe 5 hours on the floor, just walking from end to end. And it is really an overwhelming experience because you see the people who, I mean, this is their day. This mm-hmm. is their, you know, they're either dressed up or they're going to talk to somebody. They're going to go buy something. They're going to do whatever. So there's a lot of energy in the room. People talk about it, but there's this smell.
Oh, see now.
But it's not that bad.
All right. Now, I'm gonna challenge you on that. Like,
okay.
At a car show, you're gonna get a smell. At an electronics expo, you're gonna get a smell. Just a lot of humanity.
Exactly.
That's all you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm not saying that these are the unwatched masses. This is an experience. You're in a different world.
Right.
I'm thinking of it like you're landing on a different planet, and everything is different.
Did they know who you were?
No.
He's for NPR.
It's not. But as you walk the floor, I mean, you see this perfect machine of enthusiasm and a huge infrastructure that is engineered to play on that enthusiasm, to completely exploit that enthusiasm. So it's like this worm eating its own tail, in a way, and it just keeps going and going and going. But it's fascinating and it's huge. It's not just nerds. I mean, one of the things I tried to point out to some of the producers at NPR is that there's just so many normals who go there now.
Yeah,
with their kids. There are families who are, you know, dressing up their kids as Jawas, which, let's let's say that that's a little might be taking it a step too far, because that's how you get at age 13. Those kids are going to be jocks. They're going to be cheerleaders. They're going to, the whole place is going to smell like Axe body spray. I guarantee you. But yeah, it's, but there's also, in San Diego, in Southern California, it's this annual event that's treated like the Mummers Parade in Philly or New Orleans, in Mardi Gras, New Orleans. It's this thing, this tradition of what families do. And, you know, I was talking to a lot of different people there about why do you think it's become so big? Not just Comic-Con itself, but comics culture. Why has it infiltrated everything? And it's fascinating. When I talk to comic book people, comic book artists, writers, people who grew up with them, they're saying, well, it's simple. Now we have the technology for these movies and television shows to kind of take these wonderful things that are comic books, these characters that we love, and now everybody can see them. So there's no, it's not this medium that is a barrier to entry. Like, you don't have to get a comic book. You can see it on the screen. It's these wonderful stories and characters. When you talk to families, it's just, you know, it's just something we do.
Fantasy. It's, yeah.
Yeah. When you talk to people in comics journalism, bloggers, it's about the internet. It's about how I was this thing, loving this what I loved in my own little corner of the world. And I started to, when the internet happened, it basically overlaid all of these existing nerd networks of people like who would write into comics or write into Buyer's Guide or who would put fan fiction together or
did their own zines
or do zines or cosplay or anything like that. And all of a sudden, it became much easier for you to see just how many more people there were like you. Mm-hmm. And this and all these cons are just an infrastructure that it's created to kind of bring you all together and show you that you're not alone.
Yeah, and you see it at other cons too. I mean, yeah. Baltimore Comic Con has just exploded in the last few years. And
I haven't been in years, but
and I was at Chicago Wizard World a couple of years ago, and it was huge. And it was, you know, I can remember when Baltimore Comic Con was a mid-sized con, but I think what's happening is a lot of people are seeing the experience at San Diego, and oh, there's a Comic Con in my town. I'm going to go there, and so then it becomes this sort of bigger thing. The whole fan thing is changing. And that was actually one of the things I liked about your podcast that you did. You talked about Maggie talked a lot about the inclusion factor. What sort of, it used to be, this was our special little deal and you're the fan of whatever this is. And then suddenly it gets a little bigger than you.
It's accessible. Yeah.
It becomes accessible to everybody. And then suddenly it's not quite as special and it's not yours.
And every time, you get this sinister, you know, ugly part of nerddom where they kind of say, well, this isn't, you're not a real, you're not a real fan. Every time that happens, or the fake geek girl thing, and every time that happens, I'm legitimately surprised, because to me, a nerd is someone, male, female, who just has a thing that they love and they want to share it with others. Mm-hmm. The thing that unites them, it's because, again, it's not what you love, it's how you love it. And nerds love a thing with incredible depth and passion and it's enthusiasm that just spills over. And, you know, there are sports is culturally sanctioned nerddom, especially like box scores, people who go into fantasy football or fantasy baseball. That is just nerddom that everybody accepts.
Yeah, the guy who scores the baseball game is plumbing the same territory that the person who's collecting all of the issues of the Hulk.
Exactly. It's the same thing. It's the same phenomenon anyway.
Yeah.
So when in nerd culture there is this sense that, you know, Comic-Con was ours and then Twilight happened and all these other people came along, it's like
Hollywood came in and brought all this money.
Exactly. Do you not know what you're saying? Do you not know what you're talking about? Do you not, you people who are over here saying that this, because the ugly part of nerddom is, and I've said this before, it's like when you hear the sentiment of, you don't like the thing I like in exactly the same way, for exactly the same reasons, and to the exact same extent that I do, you're doing it wrong. And that's crap.
So this fed your podcast pretty well.
I'm
guessing, right?
Yeah, it was actually a good, we had a lot of people there, people who like the show, and actually, you know, and Maggie and I got a little bit into it. I didn't want to throw down with Maggie, you know.
No, hold on.
She might beat you in her nerd knowledge.
It's not nerd knowledge. Her point was that my thing about how it's weird when nerds attack each other for you know what they like, and I would argue that you know people who kind of die on the hill of, I hated the bat nipples on the bat suit in the 1990 whatever Batman film.
Move on.
Exactly. the people who die on that hill are that's a weird thing. And she says, well, no, that's just religion. That's exactly the same thing as religion. That is, the Lutheran Church. That's just nailing your edicts, your tenets on the church door. And I say, Maggie, there is a difference. There's a difference in scale. Let's say you were talking about the fallacy of the Holy See in Rome versus nipples on a batsuit.
We're talking the prequels, okay? I was there in 1977 in high school when Star Wars came out. I was a science fiction fan. I was there then when the culture changed as far as science fiction went. And there was a moment, where what you're talking about occurred. Are you a Star Wars fan? Are you a Star Trek fan?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's ridiculous. It's completely, you can't be both.
Right.
But there was a moment where there were the people who had been enthusiastically, putting on Spock ears and writing zines to each other about Star Trek. All of a sudden, there was this challenge to what they saw as the way science fiction was. And then these big movies came out, and there are all these people who were watching them, and there are all these toys and lunchboxes and dishes and sheets and everything that had C-3PO on them. I mean, there's this moment, but that seems to always happen. There was something new comes on and it sort of challenges it, and then it's just the boiling of the.
What surprised me? I'm writing a book about the history of Batman and how nerd culture intersects it. I figured that this whole notion of Batman's a badass man and he's just totally cool.
You need to talk to my daughter. Okay. She's obsessed with Batman.
Well, the 1966 Adam West television show was a goof, but we can talk about it.
It was an intelligent goof.
It was a very smart goof. And what they were doing was taking the existing comics at the time and just doing them straight. They weren't making fun of the comics. They weren't overdoing the comics. They were saying, let's take this and put it here, but do it exactly. The joke of the thing is how seriously we take it.
Right.
And the people who say that show didn't take Batman seriously are getting it exactly wrong, because that's what it did. It took Batman as he existed at the time very, very seriously. And you can see I found a zine of the time called Batmania, before Batmania was a thing, about fans of the original comics, of the 40s and 50s and 60s comics, who were just about, oh, there's going to be this show. It's going to be about Batman. And can you imagine? This is what somebody actually wrote right before. Can you imagine there's going to be pow and zap on the screen when Batman hits somebody? It's going to be great. And you're reading this with the judgment of history going, oh, you have no idea what's coming. And then you can see this slow motion car wreck as subsequent issues come out, because it's like right before the show happens, during the show happens, and they're like, huh, that's not what we thought it was going to be. And then after it, it's like five stages of grief. Every single one of the stages of grief of them, they're rationalizing, they're angry, they're sad. It's Kubler-Ross complete. And it surprised me that there would be this ownership, this feeling of ownership of a character back then, because back then Batman was flying through space and he was going on time travel, and he wasn't the dark brooding badass. He was just a comic book character like any comic book character, and the people who read him as adults were very, very rare. I mean, it was mostly written for kids, very young kids. In the 60s, that started to change over when it started to be written for teenagers. But at that time, it was written for kids and collectors like the contributors to Batmania, who felt this incredible ownership. And I think that's what you get to when you're talking about nerds. It's not just that they love the thing, but they feel like they own it.
Yes.
Well, doesn't that happen, too, with a lot of series? I mean, obviously, Harry Potter pops to mind, where you have an idea of the character in your mind, and then even if the show or the movie or whatever it is incredible, it's not what you thought it was going to be.
Exactly.
And you have that sort of transition between, okay, I have to kind of let go of my idea a little bit.
Well, you're giving it up to the world, the wider world. It was this thing that was yours, and now Hollywood is coming in and twisting it, doing something with it. And I've said before that there's the Batman television show is a good way of looking at this, because when you're a kid, if you're a nerd like me, when you're a kid, you love the Batman show unreservedly.
Yes.
Great. When you are an adult, you see what it's doing and you love it again.
Mm-hmm.
There's a period of time when you're an adolescent when all of a sudden, this isn't taking it seriously. This sucks. This isn't Batman. And I think a lot of comics culture has been trapped in this adolescent phase for the past 30 years, where it's about taking things seriously and taking it seriously means it has to be grim and ultra-violent. And, you know, these are children's characters. At heart, these are children's characters. And it's great that you want to say that there's this one version of this character. But the thing about Batman, which distinguishes him from Superman, wrote a book about him. He evolves over the course of time. He shifts as the culture shifts and starts to reflect different aspects of the culture. Batman isn't a mirror that reflects us. He's an ink blot. We project onto him all of our fears, all of our foibles. So he doesn't change. We just create more and more versions of him. So there's the Adam West Batman. There's the hardcore Frank Miller Batman from The Dark Knight Returns. There's the Michael Keaton Batman who acts completely differently than the George Clooney Batman and the Val Kilmer Batman and certainly the Christian Bale Batman. These are all different, but there's room for them all, I say.
Yes,
it's a
wide world. And then we're going to have Gotham, which is a Batman TV show without Batman.
Yeah, it's like the way I put it is like, so we're going to get like 5 or 6 years of flour and eggs, and then at the very last season and maybe the finale episode, we're going to be like, cake. Here's cake now.
Here it is. You've been waiting.
You get a glimpse of cake.
That was my entire experience with Smallville.
Absolutely.
Put on a suit, for God's sake.
So why did you pick Batman? I mean, does it seem like an obvious question to go from Superman to Batman? Or what was the choice there?
Well, the Superman book came about as kind of a work for hire. It was an editor at Wiley approached me and said, so you're writing about comics all this time. Would you like to write for me a book, a history of Superman in time for the 75th anniversary? Very marketed, very commercial.
Right.
And I was like, sure. And as I got into it, it became less... this happened, then this happened, and this happened, because that got really dull for me very quickly. I mean, I admire the people who can do those kind of straight histories, but I couldn't invest. Mm. It felt like a term paper, especially when I had to footnote it. It just felt like, okay. And so I needed to get a little bit more, not history, but like context. I went back and looking for certain contextual things and tried to make connections between, well, why did this thing persist? Why did this thing go away? That made it fun for me. The Batman book was similar to that. It was like, well, what's next? And Batman is the yang to Superman's yin or whatever. Mm. They're completely fundamentally different characters. And what I was more interested in this was the ownership of nerd culture around him and how that's changed over time. So the fact that this 66 Batman series – it was for so many years completely disowned by DC Comics and by comics culture. The Batman we want isn't this at all. And,
right.
And for a long time, you couldn't even get any acknowledgement of that. And it's fascinating for me to see now, it's finally coming out on DVD and Blu-ray, that there's that comic book series that follows that continuity now, that there's a much wider acknowledgement of the fact that this character can be fun, and there's not this one single instance of him. So that's what it was. It was such a different experience between the Superman character who evolves and the Batman character who doesn't really, who has these certain central tenets, but is open to huge interpretation.
So my understanding of the Superman book, and also I guess from the Batman book as well, they're not so much this is a history of the character. It's more their cultural
role. Yeah. I mean, I wasn't so much interested in the behind-the-scenes stuff. Mm-hmm. I love Sean Howe's Marvel, An Untold Story, Marvel Comics, An Untold Story, which is basically about – he does a fantastic job of saying, here's how the corporate culture of Marvel, as it changed over time, how office politics sort of filtered down into the stories of, you know, all these different characters. That's fascinating, but it's not what I was interested in. I'm interested in how these characters are perceived and how that – perception changes over time. So there's this idea of Batman and there's the character of Batman. The character of Batman is controlled and owned by DC Comics. The idea of Batman's a lot bigger, mm-hmm. and it's owned by all of us. And therefore we can put a lot of ourselves into it. We can take a lot of the character out and use him. And a lot of the people I'm talking to now who really love this character love him for some, I thought, pretty surprising reasons. There's a guy by the name of Dean Tripp, who is a comics artist and writer, who wrote this amazing web comic, which is now I think he's doing as a rail comic, called Something Terrible, which is about how he was abused as a kid, sexually abused and emotionally abused, and saw in Batman, who is, remember, a character to whom something terrible happens, and then chooses not to seek revenge, but to fix himself, to take what's happened to him and make sure that that can never happen to somebody else. That's the key to the character. That's the thing that a lot of people forget about when they try to make him into a creature of rage or anger or vengeance. There is, at the heart of the character, hope. This idea that I am going to become a better person and help society by making sure that what happened to me never happens to anybody else. And that's kind of the thing that's guided him. And that's what that comic Something Terrible is about. And it's fantastic. And I heard those kind of stories a lot from the fans that I talked to.
Yeah. I identify with that greatly. And my own experience with Batman and being a comic book collector and seeing how that character has changed over the years and the way people have embraced it and divorced themselves from the Adam West thing.
Right.
But it's so fascinating in the last, 10 years with the multiple, animated series and the way the books have changed and everything and the way comic books have become a part of the larger culture, the way that's sort of affecting the books.
Yeah. I mean, there are a lot of the people I talk to think that there is the Batman of the comics and that's the real one. And all these other Batman don't exist, or all these other Batman are not real, which is one of the arguments. One of the arguments the book tries to make is just get over it. They're all real. They're all Batman, dude. There's this feeling of, well, in the comics, for example, Grant Morrison's run, getting nerding out here, was the idea behind that run was everything you've ever read, seen, heard about Batman is true. So I'm going to create a storyline in which all the crazy stuff from the 60s and the 50s and the 40s.
Except Batman Incorporated?
Yeah, before that too. Just his whole Batman run is about it all happened, all the weird crap, everything. It's all part of this one character. And it's a fascinating approach, and it's a very typical Morrison. It's a very high wire, very risky approach. It doesn't necessarily work to the end, but it's brilliantly brave, and it's saying something about the character. It's saying something, basically, what I'm trying to say, which is just accept it. It's all part of the deal.
Well, and the whole ownership thing. I mean, you can look back to when DC deigned to kill Superman, that Robin was going to be killed, and the public outcry on things like that,
which comes from not from the comics cognoscenti, comics people, because the comics people know they're not going to kill Superman. They're never going to get rid of this character. They're never going to do it. And you can go back and see that the comics retailers were like, yeah, whatever. And they weren't buying that issue in huge numbers until the mainstream press started getting into it. And there's this phenomenon that happens over and over again where the news says, usually the local news says, that thing you loved from childhood is about to change.
Check back at 11.
Check back at 11. Lincoln Logs are now going to be made out of plastic. They're changing the Warner Brothers characters so they're more hip. And that gets huge reaction because we all have this idea that when we leave a thing that we loved as a kid, it stays fixed in amber. And, of course, it doesn't. It has to react to the changing times. It has to do something. So, but idea, that story lead, that story hook was pretty much created around the Superman's dying thing, and since then they've just been perfecting that whole story hook over and over again.
Well, let's slowly back out of the comic bookdom and sort of talk a little bit more about covering popular culture, because I think one of the things we try to do on the podcast is get people in here to talk about the way they work and because I'm sure there are a lot of people who would want to do something like that, who would want to cover something they love. What advice would you give them?
Well, I mean, NPR has it's an unstated policy, but and you can see it in how they cover music and things like that, which is we're not going to set out to review things and then just to trash them. We see ourselves as, well, I'm a freelancer. I'm putting my we in there anyway. As curators, not necessarily critics. So we are trying to direct your attention to things that, for criteria that we try to establish, that we try to make very clear, are worth your attention for reasons X, Y, and Z. So what that means is you have to at least convince yourself that there are in the world objective criteria for what makes a thing good or not good. It's a mug's game because everything's subjective. But
especially if it's something that you've loved.
Exactly. So the point is you have to do the homework. You have to kind of say, okay, You have to be able to explain why you love the thing that you love in the way that you love it. Or you have to be able to say why a thing works. So that's why I get hung up in a lot of the stuff, the writing I do about comics. I get hung up in writing about structure and what these characters stand for and what these characters do and what these characters mean. And then I try to cut as much of that out, that stuff that makes it boring and insular. But that's kind of the philosophy anyway.
Right, the standards that can be met in each one, anything you review.
Yeah. What is the artist, it's the same thing in criticism, this is all criticism. What is the artist setting out to do? Do they achieve it? Mm-hmm. And then the one that's trickiest is it worth doing what they set out to do? And that's the third and final question, which very often doesn't get answered and sometimes doesn't even get broached. The real challenge with writing about comics is, and I see this in mainstream coverage of comics more than I see it in comics journalism, but is we are trained to talk about story. We're trained to talk about how something comes together and how the ideas mesh. We're not trained, at least if we come from, you know, prose journalism, we're not trained to talk about the art. We're not trained to talk about how the image and the text come together and what they do. Because in a really good comic, it's not just pictures with words. It's not just drawings to kind of show you what's being said in the picture. These two things have, there's a tension between them, and that tension works in a really interesting way. And so what I set out to do, and what I talk to a lot of younger writers about, especially if they want to do anything with writing about the comics medium, which I think is really fascinating to write about now, is to make sure that you are not just doing lip service. Like when I was a theater critic, I would read these reviews all the time where it'd be like, and the scenery was by X, and the costumes were really good, and the lighting was, and it just, you can't just dump it all at the end, because it had this major effect on everything you saw and everything you felt as you were sitting there in the theater. So it's not, you can't, it's not just because you have these very hardworking people who are doing the lighting and the theater and the sets and the costumes. It's because they're part of this whole experience. And you, it's up to you to try to convey in a relatively convincing way the entire experience, not just the story.
And that listed at the end, like it's just bullet points.
Just the dump, the information dump at the end.
I imagine what would be really difficult, and tell me if I'm wrong, as a culture editor or writer, is to handle feedback.
Yeah.
Because I imagine there's a lot of it, especially now with social, and it's pretty intense.
Well, I mean, you know, NPR, I'll just be very honest. NPR, when I started there, the main reaction we got was, really, NPR? Comics? Really, NPR? Why are you talking about The Bachelor? Really, NPR? You know, and there was whole... Because they have the hardcore NPR listener has this idea of here's what NPR does, here's what everybody else does, and if I wanted to see that, I'd watch local news, I'd watch blah blah blah. But what certainly Linda sets out to do, and what NPR Music and what everybody at NPR is setting out to do, is to try to it's kind of what I talked about before. This is a thing that everybody is talking about. So instead of just denying that everybody's talking about it, let's figure out why.
Yeah.
Spend some time to figure out, what is it? What's the appeal? You can disdain the thing. You can disdain the people who like the thing, but you have to figure out why. At least you have to address why, because this is culture.
You're just addressing the curiosity of it.
Exactly. And you know, you can talk about the quality and how certain things are great and certain things aren't. But, I mean, you can't deny that this is shaping a lot of our perceptions, not just – even if you don't own a television, which I was often told, I don't own a television.
Uh-huh. You're one of those people. Mm-hmm. So it always reminds me when we talk about things like this. It always reminds me of Stephen King's speech that he gave when he won the one Publishers Award.
Oh yeah,
when he was challenging people, you know, because basically it was like, oh, you're going to give the award to Stephen King. You know, he sold a bunch of horror stories, and he challenged the publishers. Like, you know, there are a lot of people. I know there are a lot of people in this room who didn't want me to get this award, or wouldn't have given me this award. And I'm getting it pretty much because he sold a lot of books.
Right, right.
But the fact was that he was challenging them to look at the genre fiction, and that there was richness in there that they were ignoring, and they weren't acknowledging it.
that many people can't be wrong that it has value.
Yeah, just because it's popular doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad.
Not necessarily, no. I mean, I can, you know, and I have often said that literary fiction is a genre just like any other, and that instead of a wizard, you've got, you know, a
college professor.
A straight white dude in a trailer park, and instead of, you know, a mystical elf or a romance, you know, with a Highlander, you've got, a well-meaning guy and his dog. You know, And to deny that and to put one form of fiction, one form of anything over another, because you feel it is more intellectually challenging, is again, it's a mug's game, because there's the delights of genre are prescribed, they're specific, but they're not invalid. They're real.
Right. They like all good art.
They're worth talking about. And they're worth exploring, and they're worth figuring out, and they're worth kind of, you know, trying to poke at and figure out why so many people like the thing that they like.
Do you think it's important, as if somebody is looking to do this or looking to cover comics, how? I just think it would be difficult because you have the comics that you like, mm-hmm. and you really have to pull back, right, and read everything.
Well,
and what advice would you give as far as making sure? You know, you keep your radar open and you know what's coming up.
Oh, it's like anything else. As long as you know what your biases are, you're covered. As long as you can kind of identify them. As long as you kind of know that anytime, you know, I was talking about this on the podcast this week. You know, there's a section of Guardians of the Galaxy where one of the characters, the villain, says, "Necropilots, initiate immolation protocol."
You know the exact
because
sentence.
It's so awesome. I mean, he had me at necropilots. I didn't. I mean, like necropilots, I was in. But
the tear rolling
I'm
down
so
your eye.
I'm so ill prepared for this conversation.
And
by the way,
actually, yeah, I think somebody pointed out to me when I said that it was actually enact immolation initiative. But you get my point. My point is that kind of chewy, plummy, over the top thing. Mm-hmm. I'm going to eat that up with a big old spoon. Mm-hmm. But there are all kinds of comics. There's all kinds of art. There's all kinds of film, television, theater that is working in a more subtle register, and that has delights of its own. It's not going to make me want to pump my fist, but that's not what it's about necessarily. And your reaction to a piece of art, a piece of culture, anything is worth exploring if you can articulate it well, and that's what it comes down to. So when people say they want to cover this, you know, more power to them. It's just about being able to articulate something besides your opinion. Because if it's simply your opinion, even if you're a great critic, if it's simply your opinion, unbacked by anything except taste, then we're getting into taste hierarchies, and you know, that's, you know, everybody's got an opinion.
Right.
You need to be able to not defend it per se, but provide a structure, provide a context, place this thing that you're talking about in a wider culture and a wider context for the people you're talking about. Because that's ultimately, you're going to be writing about a lot of things that people will take a look at your headline and know, I'm never going to read that. I'm never going to see that movie, Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm never going to see that. So your task is to at least say, here's what you need to know. Here's what fits. Here's what it's doing that this thing that you think this is like, isn't doing.
Have you had a moment where you read something that you didn't expect to read and you're like, oh my God, I need to let people know about this?
Oh, absolutely. That's the thing. I mean,
that's got to be cool.
The joy. Yeah. That's the joy. That's why you keep doing it. Because if I just read all the stuff that I know, first of all, you know, you probably go through the same thing, Michael. But like, there's certain. If you are inundated with, I mean, I go through troughs and valleys, peaks and valleys with superhero stuff, because there's a time when it's just like I'm sent back to my, you know, I'm 7 years old again, and it's just working for me. And there's sometimes when it's just the same tropes over and over again, and there's nothing new. There's absolutely nothing new, and that's when I start to look elsewhere, and I look for other delights and find them. But then, you know, there's the stuff that you liked when you're seven never really goes away. And dealing with that intelligently in some way that's not just, let's make it dark. Let's make what happens if he kills people. Like that as long as you're doing something remotely interesting with it, that's why I keep coming back.
All of the thousands of titles that came out after Dark Knight Returns.
Doing the exact same thing. Taking the wrong lessons from it, thinking that this is what people want is, you know, a superhero who kills folk or maims them or, yeah.
Yeah. No, we talked before the podcast. You were talking about how comics sort of took a downturn in the 90s. And that was kind of the point when I left comics and started writing about Japanese animation.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for probably about 8 years. But there was a point where I remember that I was going to the place where I usually rent things, and I was looking at titles, and I was just like, okay, well, I've seen all the great directors. I've seen all this stuff. And then suddenly I realized, you know, a lot of this really isn't aimed at me. Mm-hmm. And I came to the realization, it would be nice to have like a real story that was in this world that was sort of appealing to an adult audience, not an adult audience, but an adult audience, yeah. That had a richer story for me. And that was kind of the point where I said, nah, I'm going to walk away from this.
Yeah.
That you come to, you know, you reach a point where you're like, nah, I got to try something different. I got to get something else to excite me the same way.
Right. I mean, you know, when you are blogging about a thing, like I was blogging about comics for a long time, and, you know, I would pick up something that was getting a lot of buzz, and I would think to myself, okay, I read it. It's not for me. Does that mean I don't write about it? Well, if I'm writing for NPR, I'm not going to write it to say, here's why it's not for me, because nobody cares. Nobody cares why it's not for me. But if that leads somewhere, if there's something I can say about it, I mean, there's so many stuff that's just like, you know, so a lot of superhero comics right now just feel like they're not written for me. And because they are not. They are emphatically not written for a 46-year-old middle-aged dude who's been reading this stuff for years. They're written for younger people who still find a certain level of violence and, you know, extreme, you know, who believe that you raise stakes by killing lots of folks. And that's the only way you can make people care about things. And so, you know, Man of Steel is a perfectly good example where that film was not made for me because that film's about, you know, Superman deciding, spoiler alert, to kill the villain. And
oh,
also,
I've seen it.
Okay. Uh-huh. And also,
it was for her.
And letting all this wanton destruction go on, even though that's kind of not what the character is about. The character is about doing anything he can to preserve life. And when they take it and they to make it fit into the moral universe, the gunmetal gray moral universe of the Dark Knight films, it's not. He doesn't fit in that same universe. He's a different guy. You have to treat him differently. You can't make a film like you made a Batman film about Superman. So, I mean, nerdy.
Tangent, right.
But that's the kind of thing that I could cite chapter and verse about, you know, the times that Superman has killed in the comics, but that doesn't make him, that doesn't mean that that's who he is. There's this larger idea of the character that exists outside of these individual instances, which get wiped away by continuity all the time.
You're probably a person who might have opinion about. You know, let's be like real comic book fans. Let's make an opinion about something we haven't seen yet.
Sure.
Superman versus Batman. Mm-hmm. So who's going to win that?
I don't know, man. I know that it's going to fit right into the Zack Snyder universe. And so there's going to be lots of rubble and grimness and you know,
sad Batman.
I was going to put you on the spot in a different way.
Please do.
I was going to ask what's on your radar? Like, what are the interesting projects that are going on right now that maybe you've discovered recently or you didn't expect to surprise you?
Well, I didn't expect to like Guardians of the Galaxy as much as I did because it's characters who I certainly knew, but nobody else did. And so I figured, what are they doing? And what they're doing is something very, very smart, which is saying, we're going to tell this story without continuity. It's such a smart approach. It's much a smart thing to say, oh, yeah, we're building this huge Marvel universe, but let's go way over here and just do something over here that is just fun. Remember fun? Remember when these stories about people who dress up in costumes with magic powers were fun? And it's invested with such a comedic sensibility that, man, I really dug it. There is a book, a graphic novel called Black is the Color, which is a graphic novel about this guy who's been cast adrift from his ship, set in the 19th century, I suppose. These mermaids come and they treat him in a way that is surprising and troubling. And it's just the most gorgeous, heart-stopping, beautiful black and white book that that was one of those moments when I was reading it thinking, I know what this is. I have no idea what this is. I have no idea where it's going. The amount of time I've spent lately reading graphic novels, because for the longest time I was writing the Batman book and was reading nothing but Batman, reading about Batman. And so now I'm getting back finally into reading graphic novels, comics, books, actual books with words.
What?
And it's just so it feels it feels great. Because again, when I'm writing the book, I'm writing it on nights and weekends. And that means that, you know, I come home from work where I've been writing all day and I sit down and I write all night. And then, you know, I take the weekends and I write it. And, you know, my husband is a widow to this book for, you know, over a year. And now finally, now that it's turned in and we're finally going to get a little reprieve while until the revisions start. And then that will be a whole thing.
Don't talk about that way. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so I'm just reading all the stuff that is surprising me. And I love being surprised. I love being invested in a project, a book, a movie, and not knowing where it's going.
It's nice when you're surprised. When you spent all this time trudging through this territory and then something suddenly surprises you.
Especially when so much of what's being produced is meant to comfort you and say, you know what's going to happen. Here it is. Let's hit these buttons. Let's go down this checklist. That's what the 3-act structure of Hollywood films is all about. That's what the blockbuster is all about. We'll do this thing and you'll know, you'll be surprised by the details, but not the structure, you know, but not by the overarching thing. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So where can people find your work, sir?
Okay. Well,
he's like, where do I start?
Yeah. Well, I
Google.
Yeah. I review books occasionally for Slate and for The Atlantic and for sometimes the New York Times. And so that's that. I'm going to try to get back into writing more for NPR's pop culture blog, Monkey See. I have a Twitter handle where I do dumb jokes. That's at GH Weldon, and certainly Pop Culture Happy Hour on iTunes is a fun show.
It is a fun show.
Thank you. That I do with Stephen Thompson and Linda Holmes and some various NPR personality who deigns to come in and talk to us like this. We're starting to do some live shows. We're going to have a live show up in Brooklyn next week, and we're hoping to do more of those across the country. So, because that
That'll
is
be cool.
fun. It's a totally different thing. It's a totally different animal than the in-studio show where you're sitting around talking to people around a table like this. It is much, much different, but it is a different kind of fun.
Yeah, we get to experience that in Chicago.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, we're going to be going to the Online News Association. Mm-hmm. You see the look on Megan's
Buckle
face.
Buckle up. We have no idea what we're doing. So, we're going to figure it out.
The thing it took us a while to learn, and we're still learning it, is, you know, the sitting around like this talking, it took us a while to make it a conversation and not, now is my turn to talk, and now is your turn to talk, and now is your turn to talk. Back when you're doing a live show, you're right back into, now is my turn to talk, because you've got this crowd, and when there is nothing but silence coming at you, it feels like death.
Right.
So you are just going for the joke. You are just reaching for something every time. Yeah, it's we're learning.
We're anticipating death.
Okay.
Oh, we are.
Yes,
I didn't know that. Great.
Something about death. That was the name of the book.
This was really cool.
Thanks, guys.
I know you probably didn't learn a lot. You probably knew all of this, but I learned a ton.
I always learn. Trust me, I always learn something.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.
Levels? Do you need peepops? Do you need?
I just need to know what your voice sounds like. You sound pretty good. Actually.
This would be about my level.
And I need to remember to take a photo.
Oh God!
Of you.
Camera adds 40 pounds. Never forget.
40 pounds.
So watch me paste this pathetic palooka with a powerful, paralyzing, perfect pachydermic percussion pitch. He's okay.
Man. Yeah, your peas are fine. You're popping all over the place.
Am I?
No.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure what that means.
Oh, that means you can just get the. Yeah,
I need to
I
get a
it.
Spit cream.
Yeah.
Whatever. We're not that scientific. We're not the. We're not NPR. Unfortunately, we're not. We're not. We fly by the seat of our pants.
Oh, well, that's what they do too sometimes.
Yeah, you can tell. Anyway, all right. Okay. We're going to start this thing. Do you have any questions before we get going?
No, we're good.
Okay, good. Just yak.
Sure.
We'll just yak for a bit. Right. Okay. Oh, I guess I could actually freaking read this. Oh, this isn't my questions. Fuck. I'm so.
Ain't no thing.
So organized. So where'd you guys stay at in San Diego?
I stayed at the Embassy Suites, I guess. Yeah, downtown.
Were you close to the convention center?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I never braved to stay that close to the convention center.
Well, it's a lottery, so the first time I got way out in Mission Valley, and then there came those people, there came some openings, so then you get it pulled into this wait list thing, and I got very, very close.
Well, good for you.
Yeah, yeah, it was good, because I didn't want to spend a lot of my time schlepping.
Schlepping, yeah. One year, we, you know, when they were like, oh, you got to take the train, or the whatever that transport thing is, and I did that. Yeah. I did that one year, and
the
that
shuttle.
Was... That was not great.
Mm.
But the last year I went, like a couple of months ahead of it, they were like, oh, well, no, we have available parking passes. And I was like, parking passes? And I actually parked in the building, which was like astounding.
Yeah, really.
Because then you get, well, the downside of that is then you go buy all the shit and you put it in the trunk of the car. Oh, but you know, I've got the car down there. I'll be able to put it in. And then you realize when you get back to wherever, it's like, how the hell am I getting this to D.C.?
Sure, right.
So, oh well.
But also, it must take forever to get out of that place because it's so huge.
It wasn't too bad. And actually, what was funny was because my son was there with his girlfriend, and so they left like an hour or so early because they wanted to go to one of the places off site. And so I called him, and I'm waiting out front next to this Transformers statue, and right before he pulls up, the General Lee drives by.
Right. And very cool.
And it's like, of course.
Of course.
This is how I'm ending my Comic-Con experience. The General Lee is driving by.
That's awesome.
It's Megan Clarity.
Hey,
Megan.
Hey.
Hey. I thought you were under the
nice
weather.
Nice to meet you. I took a couple Advil.
Oh, man. That's nice of you.
I'm feeling
You're feeling?
Better.
That's what that means. Resurgence.
Oh, that's very nice of you. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's
good.
Nice to meet you.
Yes. Yes. Let's see. Yeah, I realized. Well, good, because I was looking for the questions. And actually, I printed off, but I ended up printing off the wrong thing, because I'm so...
so
disheartened. Shut up!
Top of it.
Shut up! Oh, here we go.
It's funny, we're both off at 7, so usually when we do this at 7, we're like...
Yeah, right?
We haven't, like...
Well, I appreciate you guys moving it from Saturday. I should have gotten back to you guys sooner. But
no, that's okay. Before. No. It was much better for this. Our podcast is kind of in transition at the moment. We're trying to... reorganize things a little bit so that it fits in better with our schedules. I used to have Beyond the 3 a.m. shift, which was really fun.
Oh, God.
for scheduling things.
Mm-hmm.
And then she started working on some Saturdays. So
you don't have a mic.
Screen.
Thank you. I couldn't think of the word. It just depends on how sensitive they are.
How sensitive? Well, I could probably bring this one down a little bit.
As long as you're not all up in it, you should be good.
I'm not all up in it.
Then it'll pop and, what happens then. Okay.
Megan's very loud.
Oh, sure.
Can I tell this? One time he just didn't turn my mic on. Just wasn't on.
And the surprising thing is it didn't make a whole lot of difference.
Yes. It sounded echoey and bad. Yeah. And if you turn the board off, you can hear it coming out of the board, right?
You could sound echoey and bad sometimes.
Yeah, one.
Yeah, I thought I could hear myself a little bit.
It was the headphones.
Ain't no thing.
I turned them down. Okay.
Yeah. All right. Could you say that again, please? Whatever that noise was.
God, these intros are so long, dude.
I know. Right? Well, you know, hey, maybe someone should write them. Just saying.
Glenn didn't come here to see us bicker, but he's getting a first.
That's the show. That's
very
the whole
familiar
show.
To me. Trust me. Before we start the show, this is exactly the whole.
A lot of egos.
All right, right.
Where's my spot? What? Yes. Anytime. Thank you for coming.
I don't know how to take what you're saying anymore. Okay. All right.
Okay. Your mic's on.